Our last case this morning is 2021-579, State of Ohio versus Chad Bunch. For Mr. Bunch, we have Mr. Hardwick, and you will notice that Justice Fisher has recused from this matter, and in his stead is Judge Beatty Blunt from the 10th District Court of Appeals. Welcome, Judge.
Thank you.
Mr. Hardwick.
Thank you. I'm here with Charlene Boland, a supervising attorney in our youth law department, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I plan on focusing my arguments, absent questions, on the first two propositions of law, the eyewitness identification and the Aleem issue. On the eyewitness identification issue, honest witnesses can and do make unreliable eyewitness identifications, especially where, as in this case, the initial identification is uncertain, where some outside source contaminated the witness's memory, where the trauma of the attack was great, and where the assailant was a different race than the witness. And as explained in the expert's affidavit, science explains that under these circumstances, the witness's certainty has no correlation to the witness's accuracy. But as the trial court's opinion unintentionally shows, that is the opposite of what the lay understanding of eyewitness testimony is. And this is exactly why Evidence Rule 702 exists, to dispel common lay misperceptions. Further, here, in denying Chad even a hearing, the trial court applied the wrong standard for both prongs of ineffective assistance of counsel. First, it applied a blanket rule that some courts of appeals have mistakenly taken from this court's direct appeal case law that says that somehow cross-examining a lay witness is automatically a strategic decision, even absent any evidence of that, instead of calling an expert witness. And that's a blanket rule that both the trial court and the Court of Appeals applied. Second, even to get to a hearing, the trial court said that Chaz had to prove that the result of the case would have been different, just to get to a hearing, when really he only needs to show sufficient operative facts that show a reasonable probability of a different result. That prejudice decision is important because the eyewitness identification was absolutely critical to the state's case here. Without that eyewitness identification, the state is left with DNA that points exclusively to a co-defendant, the self-serving testimony of adult co-defendants who received significant leniency in return for their testimony, and Chaz's proximity to the assailants about half an hour or 45 minutes after the attack. With only this left, there is a reasonable probability of a different result. At least we've shown sufficient operative facts to get to a hearing.
Counsel, can you tell me, in the record, was there any corroboration at the trial that your client used this name that was referenced as Shorty Mack as his identity?
There was testimony from the co-defendants who got leniency in that, and so yes, there was.
Collier?
Collier, and I believe Bundy. I'd have to go double check, but Collier did. There, but and my point is, everything that came from the co-defendant can be discounted, and we're looking at a reasonable probability of a different result. And I keep hearing it every time a client signs an affidavit that's helpful to them. The prosecutor calls it the self-serving affidavit. Well, co-defendant testimony purchased through a plea agreement is also self-serving.
What was the plea agreement that Callier received?
I believe they both had single-digit sentences. I'd have to go double-check to be certain, but it was certainly shorter than the lifetime sentences where the trial court looked at my client and said, I want you to die in the penitentiary. And this deficient performance, it also, I would point out that in this trial court, both in the post-conviction hearing, both the state and the trial court relied exclusively on Collier's testimony as being the reason why Gronlund's affidavit didn't show prejudice.
What is the time frame that we're evaluating whether or not counsel's performance was objectively reasonable? We have to look at 2002, right?
To a certain extent, yes, but I also there's two responses to that, procedural and substantive. Substantively, the Dr. Gronlund's affidavit relies on studies from both 2002 and before 2002 and after. And there is a, in the amicus brief, and I should have written down the page, the Innocence Project cites to a survey, a study talking about the standard of eyewitness identification from 2001. Mm-hmm. But procedurally, the state never raised that argument in the trial court, and the trial court didn't rely on it. And part of the problem we have in post-conviction cases is something is litigated in the trial court. The state makes an argument and we respond to it. And then the state, then on appeal, the state says, well, what about these three other arguments we could have raised but we didn't raise? Well, if they raise these arguments in the trial court in their motion for judgment on the pleadings, then we can go back to our expert and say, okay, address that issue, or we can hold a hearing. I also want to emphasize, this is only for a hearing.
And I understand that, but what I'm having, I mean, we have a very detailed expert report about what the expert would have said at a hearing, right? I mean, what would have been different if there had been a hearing held? What could have been different?
Well, first of all, the trial court said, well, I'm not going to trust what you said, Dr. Gronlund, because you didn't mention you did not mention Collier's testimony. We could have had a hearing on what's the importance of that, which is actually nil, because an eyewitness an expert on stranger eyewitness identification shouldn't be talking about co-defendant identification. That's not his expertise. That's what we should have held a hearing. That's one of the reasons we should have held a hearing. We gave sufficient operative facts to show, yes, there is a witness who could have undermined significantly the state's most important piece of evidence. When they're left beyond that, they're left with proximity and bought testimony.
The question, though, well, the first question, though, is, was, by the standards of the trial, was counsel's performance objectively unreasonable, right? You've got to get past that hurdle first.
Sufficient operative facts to show that it was objectively unreasonable. And that's why this affidavit says this is what I'm basing this affidavit on what the standard is for eyewitness identification experts. And there's nothing in the record to show that if counsel had actually called an eyewitness identification expert, they would have heard anything different. Again, if the state wants to make that argument, that's something to be made at a hearing. And I think part of the problem here also, as Justice Donnelly has pointed out in a couple, Justice Bruner in dissenting opinions, is lower courts have flipped the post-conviction statute on its head and made it a burden to prove, and made hearings the exception, and made it extremely hard to have issues decided in hearing. These are the kind of issues that we have evidentiary hearings for. Okay.
But I guess my hurdle here is that, you know, the question is not whether it would have been better to have an expert, an eyewitness expert. I mean, that if you look at the Supreme Court case law, it's a pretty It's not what in retrospect was the best trial strategy. It's what was a reasonable trial strategy, and frankly, the Supreme Court set a fairly low bar for what is reasonable. And relying on cross examination has generally been considered to be reasonable. So I mean, and if I understand you say you have a hearing, but assume I believe everything in your expert's report, how still do we get past that hurdle of it was not objectively unreasonable to rely on the cross-examination strategy?
Because first of all, the case law about that is it's reasonable strategy to rely on cross-examining the state's expert, where you have an expert on the field, on the stand, when you can get the information you may need from that expert. Those cases do not address, the lower court cases address, in this case, lay witnesses, but that's not what this court said. That's not what the U.S. Supreme Court has said. When you have an expert that you can cross-examine, there may be good reason not to call your own expert, because that expert's just fine. Here, there was no eyewitness expert to be cross-examined in this case. There was no DNA. The DNA case, okay, the state has a good expert. I can see maybe I can get everything I need from them and it'll be more credible. But there is no expert here. And I also, when we were looking at the deficient performance prong, part of what the prejudice informed the deficient performance in this case. This evidence was so important, and that this and the eyewitness testimony, expert testimony, is so important in undermining that, that at some point that shows sufficient operative facts to show it makes no sense not to do that. And finally, when deciding whether to give deference to this, and I call it maybe speculative deference, because sometimes what's allowed is to let the state just wildly speculate as to potential theories, but deciding whether to give speculative deference to this trial counsel, this court should consider that this court has, on multiple occasions, including before and after this trial, found that this trial attorney neglects his client, doesn't follow through, and at the and shortly after this, after he filed this post-conviction petition, this court found him in contempt for not responding to this court's orders. This is not the stellar defense attorney who deserves that presumption of that benefit. And
are we allowed to consider that?
I don't see
it. It's not really in the record.
I would say if this court considers anything besides James Collier's testimony, I say yes, because the state's bringing in all sorts of arguments they didn't make in the trial court. And
it is in the record that funds were requested at one point.
But yes, the prior counsel, Attorney Kahn, obtained $500 to contact, and again, a procedural and substantive arguments. They didn't argue that in the trial court, so I didn't have any opportunity to consider the response to that, to develop a response to that. But the bills are available for both Attorney Kahn and DiMartino, and neither of them show any expense for that. And again, looking at the prejudice of this, given how important this testimony was and how much an expert can show, that should inform this court's decision about whether there are operative facts to get to a hearing. I'm not saying, and I can't say we win from here. This court doesn't have the power to say Chaz wins from in this right at this point. We just want a hearing on this. And if Chaz doesn't get a hearing in this, it's going to be very hard to get that. And in a sense, what the state wants us, it says we can't win unless there happens to be some offhand comment in the record that shows trial counsel wanted to do this, or trial counsel confessed. I cited the Hinton v. Alabama case in a brief where the U.S. Supreme Court looked at a failure to call an expert witness. And yes, defense counsel explained his trial strategy at a hearing. In Hinton v. Alabama, they got a hearing, and that's where the evidence that was cited in the opinions came from. This case is very similar to Hinton without a hearing. That's what post-conviction hearings are about. And unless there are other questions on that, I just want to briefly touch on, at least on the Aleem issue, which is the court shouldn't send kids to adult court without at least some finding that they're amenable to treatment in the juvenile system and that public safety requires the transfer. And in the end, what this case is about whether when you have a kid who is both is both amenable to treatment and where the public would be safer keeping that kid in juvenile court, are trial judges required to send that person into adult court even though it hurts public safety and is worse for the kid? And that, and as we said in a brief, based on the arguments in the Aleem 2 dissent and in Aleem 1, we asked this court to find that the mandatory transfer law is unconstitutional. Unless there are any further questions, I reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you. Counsel?
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court, Ralph Rivera, on behalf of the State of Ohio, the Mahoning County Prosecutor's Office, I will be splitting my time with Sam Peterson of the Attorney General's Office. Attorney Peterson will be focusing his comments to the merits of Proposition 2. I would be more than happy to answer any question regarding facts of the case and the complexity of the procedural history. I would start out by, this is the second time that this court has had this case before, the facts of this case. The first time, this court, in its own words, this case does not engender a sense of sympathy for the defendants. It described the facts of this case as a criminal rampage of escalating depravity.
Did you say defendants, plural?
I did. And I say that because it was a joint trial. The facts, the defendant's actions and his co-defendant Moore's actions, they were nearly identical. Were there some differences in their actions, but regarding the most brutal part of this case, and that is the rape, they essentially, as the victim testified, they were taking turns like it was a drinking or a water.
And yet there was no DNA evidence of Mr. Bunch.
That is correct, and the jury heard that. The jury heard all that, and
but that doesn't. The jury heard it, and are you aware of any conviction of a person based on there being no DNA who was later exonerated?
Yes, and yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And
so the fact that there was no DNA, that there was no expert, at least to give less credence to testimony. I mean, eyewitness testimony, just as stated here, is some of the most dubiously reliable testimony out there. Science has shown that. Data shows that. Studies have shown that. So with that in mind, there being no DNA evidence from what you characterize as a brutal rape, that doesn't give anybody pause that this person shouldn't have received at least a hearing.
Under the standard, and the reason there should not have been a hearing, because the expert is not going to add anything more than what's in his report. The expert report says because she did not sign her name, did not 100% identify him at that first instance, her identification is unreliable. And because we're in post-conviction, this court has the entire record before it. And the entire record includes all of the other corroborating evidence. Now, the co-defendant's testimony, we would have to say that that's completely unreliable and throw that out. But what is the other?
Well, but could the trier of fact determine that an expert's testimony is more reliable than a co-defendant's testimony, who by the very nature of co-defendant testimony is to get a better deal for him or herself?
The jury would weigh. Obviously, would weigh that testimony. What the expert's going to say is, the expert says in the report, it's unreliable because of this. But the jury still has to consider, what does the victim have to say about that identification? She, from day one, from 2001 until 2019, her statement, her explanation on that identification was nearly identical. And it never changed in 18 years. So,
are you aware of any case where a victim has identified her perpetrator, his or her perpetrator, absolutely 100% sure, certain, and been wrong?
I can't think of one off the top of my head, but I'm not going to sit here and say that hasn't happened. That has happened. But again, we have to look at, I mean, we're getting to that ultimate issue, but we have to look at that this entire record. And her memory, again, she testified, she went to the defendant in the lineup. She said, I went to this, I just wanted to see an entire body shot. The detectives could not do that. She identified all the three of them. Her first test of memory, and this is important, the first test of her memory was memorizing the license plate on that vehicle. She memorized the three letters and the four numbers. The only thing that she did was transpose the two middle numbers, the four and the two. So she,
memory of numbers or letters is different from identification of a person, wouldn't you say?
Well, it's certainly different, but it clearly tests her memory on that night. And this is, again, this is while it's happening. And as soon as she gets to her boyfriend's house, she blurts out the number. That is what they broadcast. That is her first test of memory. Again, you have to go back, and I would invite this court to look at every single time she made a statement from 2001, from juvenile court, she said, I know exactly, that's him.
Right,
as soon
but,
as she
but,
walked in that
and here, and here we are here discussing, you know, how impactful the evidence would be, which, of course, is not our call. It's just, would the trier of fact have weighed the evidence differently had there been this expert testimony? And, or as the first proposition law says, can we say from a blanket standpoint that it can always be trial strategy to not have an expert testify?
I would say now, opposing counsel has not presented this court with one case that it could, that could look at it, compare, and say, well, this court, the court found, you know, ineffective assistance based on not hiring an identification expert, not one. There's some case law regarding expert funds. Not one has been cited. In those cases, and it is not before this court, but I think it's on the same page, those focus on when the victim's identification is the only evidence. That is not the case here. That is not the only evidence. The other evidence is, again, her statements. We talked about the co-defendant's statement. The other important—
Excuse me, what about the fact that he was a missing assailant for a while, and then she saw his picture in a newspaper, and then she called her victim advocate to report that he was the missing assailant? If you juxtapose that with expert testimony, couldn't that have some effect?
When you say, could you clarify effect of the jury? I mean—
Well, no, it's effect in terms of the whether or not to grant a hearing.
I think the trial court properly denied the hearing because of the overwhelming evidence corroborating her identification. And the other corroborating evidence, I mean, we have the surveillance video showing the defendant with the other assailants at the gas station. That's where Officer Vitullo spotted the vehicle with nearly identical license plate. The victim testified that that's her earring in Mr. Bunch's ear. That's the same earring that Mr. Moore took from her that day. The officer follows that vehicle. It stops. The driver bails out.
But I mean, looking at 2953.21D, which leads to a hearing on a petition for post-conviction relief, it's first looking at whether there are substantive grounds for relief. And then there's a whole plethora of things that the court would look at in making its determination. And I understand that's what you're discussing now, but this question, I think we all know over time, this question of eyewitness identification isn't what people think that it is. And when you know that she couldn't really figure out if it was him or not until she saw it in the newspaper, I mean, wouldn't it be reasonable for the, I mean, wouldn't it be substantive grounds to hold a hearing?
No, because of the other corroborating evidence. And I know I said it, and that's my answer. I mean, the other corroborating evidence, if I can try to get through it, maybe it'll help maybe explain it. So the Officer Vitullo follows the vehicle. It stops. The driver bails out, okay? The other three assailants are the co-defendants that were ultimately charged in this case. The defendant, okay, he is spotted 0.3 miles, 5 minutes later from where this car was stopped. He told the officer, it's Officer Jones, he tells him, now Officer Jones hears this, sets up a perimeter. Defendant tells him his name is Chaz Bunch. What he tells him is that he's here because he knocks on a door, he said, this is my uncle's house. We know that's a lie because Mr. Hollins had testified at trial, yes, I vouch for him. He asked me to vouch for him because he said he was being chased on a curfew violation, so I vouched for him. But he's not my nephew. That's a lie. So that doesn't explain what he's doing in that area.
What, he didn't have clothes that matched the description.
Yes.
At that time.
So what happened was the broadcast transposed. It was broadcasted that the driver had gray sweatpants on. Mr. Bunch was wearing, I believe, navy blue or black sweatpants. And it was transposed. Moore was wearing gray sweatpants. And that was the confusion. So Officer Jones took this as, okay, well, he says his name's Chaz Bunch. They're looking for a guy that claims to be Shorty Mack. Here's a gentleman that says, yes, this is my nephew. He was, you know, coming here. So he lets him go. He learns days later that Chaz Bunch is a suspect, and they show Officer Jones a lineup. He says, yes, this is the Chaz Bunch. This is the same guy that I encountered 0.3 miles, 5 minutes away from where that car was stopped and where the driver bailed out.
Counsel, let's assume you're correct in that an independent judge would agree with you that there's credible, overwhelming evidence. Wouldn't, for transparency purposes and for protecting the integrity of your conviction, wouldn't it be better to just have this at a hearing?
at some point, there has to be an end to litigation. And here we are 20 years later. Based on the law, based on what the statute says and what the evidence in this record, no, we would not simply hold a hearing to put, I mean, from the state's perspective, we're not going to put on another hearing and have the victim have to go through this just for that. One last point on the corroborating evidence. Brandon Moore, the co-defendant, he admitted to his conduct, his trial defense was Chaz Bunch made me do it. That was his defense. Chaz Bunch made me do it. I did this, I admit it, but I did it under duress. And just to kind of clarify the facts before I see the rest of my time, there was three co-defendants. They were tried. Bundy, the driver, Bunch and Moore. Collier was the only one that did testify. Obviously, he got a single, I believe it was less than 10 years. Bundy ended up with around 13, I believe, and that's because of Bundy and Collier. There was basically no evidence that they participated in the rape of the victim.
Counsel, so if we were to agree with the appellants, what would your next step be for Mr. Bunch?
I guess it depends on which part of this case that you agree with. If we're just, are we still on the post-conviction hearing? I mean, if this court says that we have to run a hearing, our next step would be to prepare for a hearing.
Okay. What if it was number two?
Number two?
Constitutionality question.
I think that begs the question. I think an amenability hearing for a 37-year-old that's been incarcerated is not only impossible, impractical, and, you know, I think this court even recognizes that, you know, the mechanisms where you have an offender that's apprehended after 21, it's the juvenile justice system is absolutely incapable of taking on that offender.
Counsel, there was no unidentified DNA in this?
That is correct.
Okay,
that's correct.
It just was that Mr. Bunch's DNA was not identified.
That is correct. And that issue was, there was a DNA application, was litigated in the trial court, went through the Court of Appeals. That discretionary appeal was denied by this court. That issue was litigated.
Okay.
And if there are no further questions, I would cede the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, you have about a minute and 40 seconds left.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. As my colleague from the prosecutor's office said, I'm going to focus on the second proposition of law, but I want to make clear that the Attorney General's focus on that proposition shouldn't be taken as disagreement with anything the state has argued. We agree in full with the remainder of their arguments. I'd like to make two points about that proposition. One, a res judicata point, and two, a point on the merits. And I'll begin with res judicata. This court has said time and again that claims that are raised or could have been raised on direct appeal are barred by res judicata. And that's especially important here because not only did Bunch fail to raise this challenge to Ohio's mandatory bindover statute in his direct appeal filed 20 years ago, there's questions about remedy. Judge Beatty Blunt, I know you'd asked about the remedy, and that remedy question is particularly important in the context of res judicata. Bunch was 16 when he committed these rapes, and if he had filed an appeal challenging constitutionality of Ohio's mandatory bindover statute, then we might not have the same problem we have with remedy, because he could have had his direct appeal, this court could have heard that appeal, and he may have still been a juvenile, and so you could have remanded for an amenability hearing. Because he didn't raise that claim on direct appeal, it's barred by res judicata under this precedent. And I know in his reply brief, my colleague argued that the state has forfeited its res judicata defense, and that's not so. And I'd like to explain why. Because in the proceedings below, both in the Common Pleas Court and the Court of Appeals, Bunch acknowledged that this court's decision in Aleem 2 precluded his claim. Effectively, for those purposes, those proceedings, he conceded that his claim was without merit. And so the state cannot be expected, on the penalty of forfeiture, to raise every possible defense, every possible response to a claim that even the party asserting it says it's meritless. This court was the first opportunity where Bunch offered any arguments in favor of his constitutional challenge, and so it's the first opportunity the state had to respond. With respect to the procedural due process claim that Bunch raised, it fails at the first step, because under procedural due process, you have to have an existing substantive right that additional process will protect. Process is not an end in and of itself. And there's no statutory right here. We know that because this is a constitutional challenge to the statute, is alleging that the statute is unconstitutional. And there's no constitutional right either. In order to establish a constitutional right to an amendability hearing, Bunch would have had to make a substantive due process claim. He hasn't.
Wait,
and
you
so,
said process is not an end to. You said process is not an end to itself.
That's right, Your Honor.
Where do you get that?
Under the procedural due process test, whether you're looking at the fundamental fairness test in Patterson or whether you're looking at the three-part test in Matthews, for example, in Matthews, we don't agree that that test applies, but the first step of that test is there a substantive right? And so process always under procedural due process has to be protecting an existing substantive right. And so here, you would have to have a right to treatment as juvenile, and then the additional process he is arguing for would have to be necessary to protect that
right. What I don't understand about this whole procedural due process idea is that here, there was no adjudicate process that essentially says you're going to adult court. Essentially, the legislature passes a law that says anyone who meets these criteria goes to adult court. So there's no, I mean, it's automatic, right? It's mandatory.
Yes, Your Honor.
For those people. So, I mean, so the only procedures here are the ones that Congress employs to put this class of people, or not Congress, but the state legislature, put this class of people in adult court. So how can you even have a procedural due process claim?
I share your confusion, Your Honor, because I think in order to have a procedural due process claim, you would have to say that the General Assembly's decision to define these certain individuals as adults for purposes of courts, for juvenile court jurisdiction, I think it would have to say that is violating some right, and there's no substantive.
That would be a substantive due process claim, not a procedural one.
It would be, Your Honor. And I think that there's no, one, Bunch has not raised a substantive due process claim, and two, there would be no basis for one. Substantive due process, of course, asks whether a particular right is grounded in those longstanding nation's history and traditions, and juvenile courts, the mere existence of juvenile courts, simply do not. The first juvenile court didn't exist in this country until at least 30 years after the 14th Amendment was adopted. And so you can't say that there was a right to juvenile proceedings that was protected at the time the 14th Amendment was adopted, because juvenile proceedings simply don't exist. And like one last point,
So due process didn't have any kind of protection for rights that were created after that? So it only, are you being textualist here?
No, if a right was created, for example, if the General Assembly did create a right to a juvenile proceeding, then procedural due process protects those rights that were statutorily created. I'll give the example of Kent. I know my colleagues talk about the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Kent. In that case, Congress had created the right to an investigation statutorily before a juvenile could be transferred to adult court. And the court there said, well, this additional process is needed to protect the statutory right that was created by Congress. And then Congress amended the statute following Kent, eliminated that right to an investigation, and then the U.S. Court for District Appeals for District of Columbia found no constitutional problem with the decision to amend the statute with the removal of the process that had previously existed. And so if there is an existing right, and if it's newly created after the 14th Amendment, then absolutely, the 14th Amendment provides procedural due process protections for those newly created rights. But it doesn't create a substantive right in and of itself under a substantive due process claim. But again, I don't think we need to get there in this case, because again, Bunch has not raised a substantive due process claim.
Thank you.
one of the most important reasons why Chaz was not allowed to get, why he lost that DNA case, was that the state argued the eyewitness identification was so strong. So the state wants to deny the DNA petition because the eyewitness is so strong, but then they want it both ways. The remedy in this case for the Aleem argument is that the time left in the juvenile system is a factor for the trial court to consider at the amenability hearing that we're asking for. So that's baked into the remand.
Counsel, how can you have an amenability hearing at this late date?
It would be an evidentiary challenge for Chaz, but you can hold it, and he basically would have to show that he doesn't need the amenability anymore. And I would, but this is going to be normal for this sort of case. These sort of amenability hearings can be held, especially after a case has gone through the Court of Appeals in this court, when there's precious little time left in the system. And it's just one of the many factors. And if the juvenile court says, well, there's no time left, therefore you're not amenable, well, then he loses. Then it's going to be hard for him to win that.
So what would he have to show at the amenability hearing at this late date?
He'd have to show that the public safety would be better served by him not remaining in the adult system. And that's, I admit, that's going to be a hard...
Has that ever transpired where there's been an amenability hearing that you know of here in Ohio at this late date?
I don't know, but I do know that they've happened very close. They have happened very close to the 2021 year old, to the time when they've happened very close to the time that the person is coming 21, where there's precious little time left.
So effectively, if the court said that he was amenable to being dealt with in the juvenile system, then he'd be done with his term, right?
Yes, he'd be done. And yes, he would be done. And responding, one other thing, the Attorney General says that they couldn't raise affirmative defenses in response to our claim. Well, I've seen lots of times when prosecutors say, I'm wrong on substance and I'm wrong on procedure. My friend on the other side very easily could have raised a res judicata defense. There's no excuse from raising res judicata because the person loses on the merits as well. Res judicata is an independent affirmative defense, independent of the merits. Even if you think the person loses on the merits, then you still have to raise it. And finally, the victim was certain of Chaz's her identification of Chaz once she saw Chaz identified as her assailant in the Vindicator. I concede that. She was uncertain before she saw him identified as her assailant, and she became certain when she saw it, and she was consistent every time thereafter. And that is why we needed an eyewitness identification expert, and that's why this court should grant him a hearing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you adjourn court, please?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.